Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.ByteRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my special guest is Steve Elton, also known as L.A. Knight. Steve writes under his pen name, L.A. Knight, in his series of books, which the book we're going to be talking about today is Dog Training the American Male. He recently had his New York Times best-selling book, Meg, picked up by Warner Brothers. And while that blockbuster movie is being filmed, Steve decided to release Dog Training the American Male. And the book is already being circled by producers. After he signed the Warner Brothers contract, he turned around and purchased the rights back to some of his select books and started a traditional publishing company to help other authors. Steve also created a nonprofit organization called an Adopt an Author for school systems to educate our youth. For more information about the book, Dog Training the American Male, you can visit the website LANightEntertainment.com. And for more information about Steve's other work, you can visit the website SteveAlton.com. And I do have direct links to both websites in the show page description. So with that, I'd like to welcome L.A. Knight, Steve, to the show. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Robert.
Well, this is a real pleasure, and to be able to have someone who has been a writer for as long as you have and have such a wide variety of experiences, I'm really looking forward to hearing the wisdom that you can provide us. Let's start first of all. As I mentioned, the Dog Training the American Male, you've written under your pen name, L.A. Knight. First of all, before we even kind of talk about the book, can you explain, why is it that you use a pen name for this series? And, for authors out there who maybe want to know, the benefits of a pen name or not, what's your opinion on that?
Well, first, I've been... My first book was published 20 years ago, and I'm actually, most of my books are thrillers, written under the name Steve Alton, which is my real name, and Dog Training the American Male was my first comedy, romantic comedy, so I felt that because the genres were so totally different that it should have its own name and own professional outlook. Mm-hmm. Just L.A. Knight versus Steve Alton. So that's why I incorporated a pen name. But, everything else that I've written, the other 16 books, are all under Steve Alton.
Okay. Well, that makes sense with a different genre. And how did you select L.A. Knight? Unusual, name. For authors out there, I wrote one book or a couple books, but it's, a couple of my friends, I belong to a network of authors, and a couple of my friends within that network, have entertained the idea of, nom de plumes, but haven't really kind of gone through that and struggled with trying to identify what that would be. So how did you pick L.A. Knight?
Well, I lost my father 5 years ago to cancer, and his name was Lawrence Alton, and he was our knight in shining armor. So L.A. stands for Lawrence Alton, and Knight is who he was to us.
Oh, great. Okay. Well, that makes perfect sense. Well, let's start talking a little bit about dog training for the American male. Dog Training the American Male. Can you explain to the listeners what the book is about?
Yes. The story actually centers around Dr. Nancy Beach, who's a relationship counselor who hosts a local radio show in South Florida, which is called Love's a Beach. And the problem is that the relationship guru can't seem to make her own relationships work. which destroys her credibility to her listeners, and her ratings are in the toilet. But she set up on a blind date with a guy named Jacob Cope, who's like a walking thesaurus of phobias, and now he's dating a psych major, so the two are, you know, either perfect for each other or the relationship is a ticking time bomb. And their siblings don't care. They're sort of desperate to get rid of them, so Jacob's Jacob and Nancy move in together days because their leases were both up. And when the honeymoon stage ends abruptly, as they all do, Nancy's sister convinces Jacob to buy her sister a little white foofy dog because it's a pet she enjoyed as an insecure child, and she feels like that would make him more of a family. But being a typical man, Jacob doesn't listen, and he goes to the dog pound, and he comes home with Sam, which is a 120-pound German Shepherd. And basically chaos ensues. Nancy flips out. She hires a dog trainer, and the dog trainer convinces her that, you know, once she starts training the dog, she realizes that, you know, the dog is a lot like her boyfriend. They have the same kind of thinking. They have the same kind of bad habits. If the dog training works on the dog, maybe it'll work on Jacob too. So that begins sort of a laugh-out-loud social experiment that every couple and dog owner can identify with.
Yeah, that is. I mean, it's a perfect setup. Now, when the dogs come in, do you have experience with dogs? Is this is you know how maybe it became maybe easy for you to write about that?
Yeah, actually, we've had dogs. My first German dog trained with the trainers that were in the book. So there's a experience going there. The first trainer we hired was a woman who believed in the reward system. And the second trainer we hired was a former trainer for police dogs. So we went from both hammocks, and that's in a major part of the story.
Okay, all right. Well, that's good. You know, it's I have been told often is, you know, one of the best things to do is you know, write using your experience. And, you know, that's why I was wondering if you had that particular thing, you know, as
Robert, that inspired me to write the dog book in the first place was I actually came up with the concept for Dog Training the American Male after a bad argument with my wife. And I could not understand for the life of me how my simple, innocent statement had become so miscombobulated in her mind. It was like, you know, I was playing checkers and Mr. Simple-Minded and my wife was three-dimensional chess. And in the middle of the argument, she starts yelling at the dog, and the dog listens to her perfectly. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, later that night when I'm sleeping in the guest room, you know, how is it that the dog who doesn't speak English understood everything she was saying, but I can't get it? And then I started realizing that, you know, dogs and men are kind of the same. We're both simple-minded creatures. We both think simplistically and straight-lined. And, you know, when a guy talks to a guy, there's no misunderstanding. But when a guy talks to a woman, you know, it's sort of like walking through a minefield sometimes. And
yeah.
I realized, well, if the dog can be trained and the dog doesn't understand English, then why can't a man be trained? And that gave me the idea for Dog Training the American Male.
Okay. Well, you know, now, you know, the idea is, you know, obviously for women to train their men. Is the book, is it written so that couples, you know, both men and women would kind of get it, you know, and enjoy it?
Absolutely. Well, women will love the book, and men should definitely buy it for their spouse or their girlfriend because they get the treat. You know, you have to realize that, you know, I'm not trying to insult men and our dogs. I'm saying that there's a reason that men and dogs are best friends. You know, when we're pups, we both love to play ball. If there's no toilet, we have no problem peeing on a tree. We both take pride in stupid things like our bowel movements. You know, what guy hasn't launched the perfect and gave it a good look before flush. I could tell by the way you're laughing that you've done this before. You know, you got to uh-huh. take a look at the ball because there's pride and ownership there. But imagine a woman doing that. You know, dogs howl when they're happy. Men howl when, you know, we score a touchdown. You know, dogs and men are both being yelled at for innocently dragging mud into the house or, you know, maybe occasionally humping the wife's leg when she's not in the mood. So, you know, we are like dogs, but in the sense that we like things simple. You know, feed us, give us sex, let us lounge on the sofa occasionally, watch football on Sundays. You know, we're pretty happy creatures. You know, just tell us what you need and so we understand it. And so we would rather be trained as opposed to be left guessing. You know, I don't know if you're married, but, you know, my wife, you know, she'll say to me something like, I'll ask a question and she'll say, you know what I mean. Well, if I knew what you mean, I wouldn't be asking you. You know, just give it to me simple. Don't keep me guessing because life's too complicated as it is. I would rather things laid out nice and clean and simple. And then we get it. Guys like things simple, straightforward. But a woman, you know, women are complex creatures. They think, you know, in complex detail, you know.
Patterns,
A couple weeks ago, I got into an argument with my wife, and, you know, she started bringing up stuff that I did 18 years ago. How can I defend my behavior 18 years ago? You know, it's like her brain has a built-in Google search system that instantly picks up the phrase that I had accidentally spewed out while I was making my turkey and mayo sandwich in her kitchen. And, you know, all of a sudden I'm in a fight that took place 18 years ago. It's like she zapped me back into time to start an argument.
Yeah,
I can't think
like
of that. I'm a dumb creature. I'm a dumb animal. Don't overcomplicate it.
Yeah, it's like type in those keywords, and all of a sudden you got 50 links, you know, to pass actions and words.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that, you know, I think is one of the positives to this is the fact that, you know, you're using humor. You're using, you know, humor to really kind of make some solid points about relationships. And I think, you know, just the fact that you're using humor, and now I understand this is kind of like a PG-17 kind of content in the book. Is that correct?
You can say that. Yeah, it's, you know, it's not something I would give my 14-year-old to read, but I mean, there's no graphic sex or details, and, you know, but it's how couples talk.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I was reading some of the 5-star reviews it's gotten on Amazon, and people really enjoyed the humor, and it was interesting, you know, the number of couples who kind of gained, you know, insight, you know, from both of them reading it.
Yeah, you know, that's definitely true. I mean, the book was written from a guy's perspective. For a guy, but women love it because, you know, they're in control. And let's face it, women are in control. We'd like to think we're in control, but, you know, a man doesn't give a woman the silent treatment. A man doesn't tell his wife that he's not having sex with her for a week because she got in an argument with him. And we don't think that way.
Yeah.
We're strong proponents of makeup sex.
Yeah, nothing like it. Nothing better.
You think a woman coined the phrase makeup sex? No, that was a guy.
Yeah, exactly. Now, is it possible for you to maybe read an excerpt or two from the book so that the listeners can get a good idea of the style and the content?
Sure. There's a scene in the first chapter where we meet Nancy, who's the main character, and her sister, Lana, who's a lesbian who's dating a bodybuilding female. And they're all living together in a small apartment, and Nancy's depressed. And Lana basically says to her sister, Nancy, guys are like dogs. They need to learn the rules when they're puppies. Next time you fall for a guy, instead of jumping up and down on Oprah's sofa like Tom Cruise trying to convince the world he's not gay, teach the dog not to get up on the sofa. Set some boundaries with your boyfriend. House train the little prick.
Okay. All right.
Then there's
some real visuals with that one.
Meanwhile, there's Jacob Cope, and his brother, his older brother Vinny, is a gynecologist in Boca Raton. And Vinny's been married for 15 years. He says to, you know, he's trying to give his little brother advice. He says, you know, Jacob, I've been married to Helen for 15 years, and I still can't get her to replace the roll of toilet paper so the paper hangs over the top. Sure, it used to bother me. That was my ego talking. Then I realized that by losing, I was actually winning. See, women's brains are wired to rule the nest. It's the natural order of the jungle. Take the lion, the king of beasts. Who hunts for the food? The lioness. Who takes care of the cubs? The lioness. You know what the male lion does all day? He lays around and licks his balls. So who really wins here? The male, that's who. All you need to worry about are those 5 days a month when the devil possesses her brain and you're fine.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, that is a riot. That's great. Now, when in this particular book, this is the first in what's going to be a series, is that correct?
Well, I've got other comedies that I want to write under the name pending L.A. Night, but whether or not there'll be a sequel to this will depend upon how the book does.
Okay, all right. Well, that's great. Well, this is great. Okay, well, let's go ahead, and I'm going to take just a quick break, and then do invite listeners, if you want to call in and ask Steve any questions. You can call in at 619-789-4359. And then when we come back, I want to go ahead and shift and talk about your other work. So everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after this brief break. Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope that you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link to the approximately 1,000 shows that we have had over the past 5 years. Our show is available as a free podcast in the iTunes Store. You can subscribe there, or even quicker, there is a link to our show on iTunes on our website homepage. We are also on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Pinterest, etc., and we have buttons to those platforms on the top of our homepage. And finally, also on the site is a link to the great products we provide: books, greeting cards, photography, and a wellness store with essential oils and personal and spa products. There is so much for you to explore and enjoy on our website, www.biteradio.me. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show. Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us. Again, today my very special guest is Steve Alton, and during the first part of the show, we've been talking about his newly released book, Dog Training the American Male, which was published under his pen name, L.A. Knight. Again, you can find out more about that book by visiting the website, laknightentertainment.com. And for other information about Steve's other books and work, you can visit the website, www.stevealton.com. And again, I do have direct links to both websites in the show page description. Okay, so with that, we're back, Steve.
Yes.
Okay, great. Okay. Well, I'd like to start with, you know, as I mentioned in the introduction, you have your best-selling book, Meg, was picked up by Warner Brothers, and it's going to be a great blockbuster movie. I can't wait to see that. There are probably hundreds of thousands of authors out there who would love the dream of having their book made into a movie. Can you maybe talk a little bit about how this came about, for you, you know, what was the process that kind of led to this wonderful chain of events?
Well, first of all, Meg is short for Carcharodon megalodon, which is the 70-foot, 70,000-pound prehistoric cousin of the great white shark. And this was a real creature, the most fearsome predator ever to inhabit our planet. And it existed about anywhere from 10,000 years to a million years ago, and over the last 30 million years before that. So this is not like a dinosaur that disappeared 65 million years ago. These creatures actually existed, and chances are primitive man was around when they were still in the oceans. So I wrote the idea came to me in 1995 when I picked up an August edition of Time magazine, and on the front cover was the Mariana Trench. And the Mariana Trench is the deepest part of the Western Pacific, a 7-mile deep, 1,500 mile long gorge that's basically unexplored. And the article talked about hydrothermal vents and unbelievable chains of life that existed that we never knew about. And when I read the book, you know, I married the idea of Megalodon with the Mariana Trench. And I set a goal that I was going to write a book. Now, I had never written a book before. And essentially what I did was I set a goal that I was going to take 30 days to do the research, see what I had, and then I was going to, you know, do what you basically do to eat an elephant. You know, the way to eat an elephant is a bite at a time. And so I was going to write a page at a time. And because I already had a job, a J-O-B, a just over broke, I had to work on the manuscript from 10 o'clock at night till 3 in the morning and on weekends. So basically, wow. I set up an old word processor in the dining room, and my wife wasn't too happy about that. But I said, honey, this is what I want to do. Of course, I didn't give up my day job at the time. But, you know, we were struggling, and it was tough to focus. But, you know, once you set a goal and you stick with the goal, then that gives you your ability to focus through your problems. And so I wrote about 4 pages a night, and I finished the book in about 6 months. And I had no ins in publishing, and I took out a book on, you know, Publishing for Dummies, how to get published, and it said that you need a literary agent to represent your work, because if you send your book into the publisher, it's just going to end up in the waste paper basket. They don't want an unsolicited manuscript. Mm-hmm. So I sent out 2-page query letters, as the book explained to do, to every literary agent who handled fiction. And of these 60-plus letters that I sent, I heard back from about 3 people, and only one was really interested, and he was a guy who lived out in Los Angeles. And he felt that Meg would make a good bookend movie. He said, but it needs a lot of editing. He said, editing is like cutting a fish. You chop off the head, you chop off the tail, and you start with the meat in the middle. And he said, uh-huh. I'll help you edit the book, but I have to charge you editing fees, and he wanted $6,000.
Wow.
Now, this was back in 1996. Now, I didn't have $6,000. I don't think I even had $600. But I had a 1971 Chevy Malibu convertible that my dad had bought me when I was 17, and it was a classic. And, you know, I fixed it up and sold it and borrowed some money from some other people and paid the editing fees. And at the time, I took a job working in a wholesale meat company. Not that I knew anything about meat, but it was kind of a crazy story. One day I was working in my home, and I got a call from a guy who said, hey, I could have been your father. I was like, what kind of genetic mix happened? Am I involved in? He said, I used to date your mother when she was in high school, and now I own a wholesale meat company, and why don't you come over and I want to meet you. You know, why he would want to meet me, I have no idea, but I felt, okay, what the hell? So I drove over. It was about half an hour away, and 2 hours later I came out with a box of steaks and a job as a sales manager. And
wow.
So while I was working on the book, I was working at this wholesale meat company. And September 1996 comes along, Friday the 13th, my good luck day, and I went to work and found out that I had been fired. Turns out that this wacky family, which will be my next comedy book called Mince Meats, I had pulled the family together again to operate the company, and they no longer needed me. So I went home. I had no job. And now at the time, the manuscript for Meg had been optioned by Hollywood Pictures, which is owned by Disney. And so we had the option, and 6 days after I was fired, we took the book out to the six biggest publishing houses in New York. And buoyed by the fact that we had the first look movie deal, we had a two book deal for seven figures.
Wow.
The concept for my second book, which is a Mayan calendar doomsday prophecy, which eventually would be Publishers Domain, and the Meg deal. So I, you know, I went from the crap house to the penthouse in one phone call, and you know, things were looking up, and that was where the roller coaster started, because at that point that was on my high, and then the roller coaster was headed down. I just didn't know it. And what happened was that I was writing my second book, and meanwhile at Disney they were trying to get a good script for the movie. And while they were doing that, the president of Hollywood Pictures, David Vogel, was fired. So when an outgoing studio president, when a new president comes in, he cancels all the projects done by his predecessor unless they've been greenlit, because if they turn out well, then it's going to make the other guy look good.
Oh.
So it's all about the ego. So my Hollywood Pictures deal was canceled. Meanwhile, Meg had gone on to become a New York Times bestseller and was the book of the Frankfurt Book Fair in 1996, and was sold to 30 other countries. But with the movie deal down, and then Bantam Doubleday was purchased by a German conglomerate called Bertelsmann at the time, and the outgoing president of the company was trying to make her bottom line look better, so she canceled my second book deal.
But
we had just we just bought new cars, and we had just moved in from an apartment to a new house. And 2 weeks before I was supposed to get paid $1 million, they canceled my book.
Oh my God!
And so, you know, just in the taxes alone that I owed, I was in trouble.
Yeah.
So we ended up, you know, I had to reset my sights pretty quickly, and so I've been writing the Mayan calendar book for a year and a half, and they canceled it. And I needed to get the book back because they had already given me advances against it. So in order to get the book back, we had to sue my publisher, which is not the way I recommend anybody start off their career. And we settled out of court, and meanwhile, I wrote the sequel to Meg, which is called The Trench. And that hit the New York Times bestseller list, but I had been paid pennies on the dollar of what I got on the first deal, which is still enough to help me stay in the house for a couple years, but we ended up having to sell it and start over again. So we got the rights back to the Mayan calendar book, which I completely rewrote as a book called Domain. And that was to my third publisher, so I had three books out with three different publishing houses. And I stayed with Tor Forge for quite a while, and they've been my publisher over most of the last 20 years. But the Mayan calendar book did okay here. It didn't hit bestseller list. But years later, it was sold overseas, and it did hit number one in several countries, and it was an international bestseller. So you never know how things are going to go. You know, a book that's not appreciated in the United States, although a lot of people really like the book. And the reviews were really good, but it was overseas that book really made its mark. And so we had you were asking about the movie. I had the movie rights back, and a friend of mine, Nick Nunziata, who's the founder of Chud.com, Cinematic Happenings Under Development, he had a friend who's Guillermo del Toro, the director, and Guillermo del Toro's producer, Lloyd Levin, took a look at the project, and they optioned it from me. And they took it to New Line Cinema with the director Jan de Bont attached. And New Line hired a new screenwriter who took it in an entirely different direction than the book was. And unfortunately, New Line Cinema's big mistake was that they undersold the foreign rights to the project, because their last 10 movies had been like flops in Europe. And so they gave Meg at a discount because that's the one that the foreign buyers really wanted. And when you undersell the foreign rights, you can't co-finance the deal. So they couldn't get good finance. So they ended up canceling the deal after 2 years. So the rights reverted back to me again. So I've been at the altar twice now, and I've been left at the altar twice. So what I did was I optioned the book to a friend of mine who's a producer, Belle Avery, and Belle Avery's forte was raising money. And she really believed in the project so much that she sold a lot of things of her personal belongings to undergo this transformation and raise the money herself. So to make a long story short, where she worked extremely hard, Belle was able to team up with a Chinese production company called Gravity, and Gravity put up the money, $150 million, and they took it to out for distribution to Warner Brothers, and Warner Brothers said, you know, we love the project, we want to be a part of it. So they bought in, and then over last summer, they attached John Turteltaub to be the director, and Jason Statham is the star, along with Bing Bing Lee and Ruby Rose and Rainn Wilson, and there's a lot of international stars in this movie, and they've been filming since August 29th in New Zealand, and the filming will take them into China as well.
Wow.
So that's where we stand with the movie.
That is, I mean, that story, there is just so much in there for authors to, you know, to kind of contemplate. I mean, you know, you had the ups and downs and politics and the international aspect. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, it seems that, you know, you just kind of have to persevere and really be prepared for that roller coaster, like you mentioned, as much as possible.
Yeah, and I mean, Robert, there's no way to prepare for it. I mean, the stress alone was, you know, let's put it this way. 10 years ago, I was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, which I still have today. And, you know, I'm hoping for a cure, and I'm trying some other things that are, you know, out of the box to try to control it. But, you know, stress is one of the things that can cause some of those things. So, and it's been an interesting journey.
That
I wrote a book years ago
sure.
called The Shell Game, which is a fictional thriller about the end of oil and the next 9/11 event. And it was based on real things that happened that, you know, the authorities, the government doesn't want us to know. And, you know, when the book came out, or just before it came out, I was getting threats and phone calls this morning and emails from strange people who knew all my information. So
That's scary. Yeah. Yeah.
This is the life you chose, as you say in The Godfather.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Well, it certainly might have been a headache, but never was a bore. You know, with the one thing that I also understand is that, you know, you bought back the rights to certain select books of yours. How does it happen that you get, these options, you know, for movies, for your books? Is it basically once it's a bestseller that people kind of come to you with that offer?
Well, two different things, sort of break them up. Getting the rights back to my own book. I was able to acquire the rights back to Meg when I'd written a book, my eighth novel called The Lock. It was about the a factual story about the Loch Ness Monster, what's really down there. And I had an offer from Torforge, but I had also had another deal worked out with a friend of mine who had opened up an entertainment company in it, and I convinced him to open up a publishing company, which he did, and bought The Lock. And The Lock sold a lot of copies, got great reviews, and it's also been optioned for a movie by Belle Avery and the people, the production company in China. And what happened was that when we knew that the movie deal was going to be secured at the time by New Line, before it was announced, the publisher decided that we should buy back the rights to Meg from Doubleday. So we bought back the rights, and then when the publishing company went out a year later, I got back the rights myself. I made a deal that I would pay for the rights when the movie deal was paid for. So we worked that out, and I got the movie, I got the publication rights back to Meg, and we had set it up at a small publishing house just to basically fulfill orders through the Adopt an Author company because so many teachers were using the book in schools, which we'll talk about. But what happened was is that when Warner Brothers announced what they did, you know, I decided, you know, I could sell this book to another publisher and make some money.
Mm-hmm.
Or I could do it myself, set up a publishing company with some friends, with some talented people that I knew in publishing, and some investors and some and movie producers, and try to do it that way. And if I was going to do it that way, there were two projects that I wanted back. I had optioned two books to a small company, and the two books were Shark Man, which is about sort of like Spider-Man for sharks. It's about a paralyzed teen, Quan Wilson, who gets a hold of some shark stem cells from a medical facility that's trying to get through breakthroughs using shark stem cells, and he injects it into himself and starts turning into a predator. And the other book was Dog Training the American Male, which had come out in trade paperback, and neither book was supported, and neither book had good covers, and neither book had any publicity. And I felt that they were left to die on the vine, and I knew that both would make great movies and have a good following. And so I made a deal with the publishing house to buy back the rights to both of those books, which they were kind enough to sell me. And so we started a publishing company, you know, basically founded upon those three books, the Shark Man, which will come out in paperback later in 2017, and Dog Training, which just came out a couple weeks ago, and Meg, which I rewrote the entire book last year and expanded it and cleaned it up and added an unpublished prequel. And so that's the book that's out there now under A&M Publishing, which owns Viper Press and WJM Books, which is under the umbrella company that Dog Training is published under. So I'm a part owner in a publishing company that's now publishing my books.
Okay, well, great. God, it's wonderful to be able to have that structure, to be able, you know, because that support structure is just so important when you're trying to get your work out there. Now, is this publishing house open to, I mean, is it traditional in that you receive, open to receiving submissions from other people, or how exactly,
yeah,
or is it just we
are accepting submissions from other authors. With the caveat that every book is a partnership. If we like the book, you know, we'll help edit it, we'll set it up, we'll publish it, we'll print it, we'll drive publicity to it. But it's a partnership between the author and the publisher so that it's not traditional. Because the truth of the matter is that if you go into publishing today and you think that you're not going to invest any money in your own book, I'm not talking about self-publishing now, which is all your own money. But
right.
It's a partnership between the author and the publisher. You're not going to find many publishers who are willing to spend, you know, $50,000 on a marketing campaign for a book for a new author, or even an established author, unless that author is really at the very top. You know,
right?
Because publishing has just changed completely over the last 20 years that I've been in it, and so what A&M publishes. A&M Publishers does, and we have a website, aandmpublishers.com, is that we partner with authors and work with them together to give them a chance to get up at the plate to hit a home run. And that's really all that you can ask for these days. There's no guarantee what's going to sell. The competition is fierce. But we'll do our best to help work with you to get it out there with the understanding that you're going to work just as hard. And that
right.
comes from my the last 20 years that I've been in publishing as an author, every book that I've ever written, I've had to put my marketing money into. I've had to generate publicity, because if you rely on the publishing house to do it, it's not going to get done. You know, I have graphic artists who create my own covers because I didn't like the covers that the publishers were doing because they were just, you know, a typical publisher may have 300 titles in fiction that they're doing every year. And so the art director doesn't have time to read the book. They have no idea what the book's about. They're given a basic concept of what the title's about. And then they're supposed to create an art cover that is going to lure people to buy your book because, you know, there's an old saying, don't judge a book by its cover. But, you know, the first thing that they judge a book by is by its cover.
Exactly.
You know, my Meg books have ferocious sharks on their front covers. Well, the first cover that was ever designed for Meg was by Doubleday. They did a decent job on the hardback, but there was no shark on the cover. And they did a horrible job on the paperback, which was a black cover that said the word Meg in it in black letters. Now, how would you know what that book is about?
Wouldn't have
you
a clue.
You would think it's an autobiography about Meg Ryan. You don't know. And this is a company that did Jaws 25 years earlier. And we all remember what the cover of Jaws looked like, this ferocious shark coming up under a naked woman swimming along the surface. And that was an iconic cover. And now they, for Meg, it's like they almost didn't want to sell the book. So I've had arguments with publishers over the years, and basically I've taken it upon myself to invest my own money into my own covers because, you know, this is my career. This is what pays my bills. This is what supports my family. And I've got to take control of it because I can't rely on a publisher to do it because they've got so many other books they're publishing, you know, unless you're – the top 1%, unless you're a Stephen King or, you know, somebody like that, or J.K. Rowling, you can't command that kind of respect. So, you know, I've been a New York Times bestselling author for, you know, four of my titles have been New York Times bestsellers, and four of them have been international bestsellers. I've been number one in different countries, and yet I still don't have enough sway to get that done. So, you know, my publishers...
Well, you know, With the traditional too, and working on so many titles, a lot of times that they'll use templates or you know something, you know that they've used. So the ability to have something unique, you know, to your particular work is lessened by the kind of the factory, you know, kind of system that they have to use.
Exactly, and A&M Publishers is never going to be we're never going to publish more than 10 titles a year. But the ones that we publish, we want them to be big sellers. So we try to look for books that have movie potential or TV potential. We try to look for things that have a solid hook. You know, we've got a terrific book coming out in March called Unacknowledged. There's actually two books called Unacknowledged. One's mine, the novel, and the other is written by Dr. Stephen Greer, who's the foremost authority on UFOs and extraterrestrials. And he's never been with a publisher before. He's always done it himself because he never trusted a publisher until he met with me and A&M Publishing. And, you know, we're not going to edit anything he doesn't want edited. We're going to put it out exactly as he wants. We're going to put the book cover out that he wants. And we're going to get behind the book. And you know, because it's a team effort, and he's got a terrific book and a lot of followers. And it's important. Both of these books carry an important message.
Great. Well, boy, I'm going to keep my eye open for that one. That my listeners are right in line with with what that topic would be. So I'll keep my eye open for that. Well, that's great. Now, one last topic that I kind of want to touch on is I mentioned in the introduction that you started a nonprofit organization called Adopt an Author for school systems. So can you talk about that? Because I think that's sounds like a great program.
Yeah, what happened was is when May came out in 1997, I started getting inundated with emails from teenagers who were all saying the same thing in the email. They were saying they hate reading, but they read Meg, and Meg was the first book they ever finished. And then I started getting emails a couple months later from teachers, English teachers, science teachers, language arts, reading, who were basically saying that they discovered Meg gets students to read. And they were using the book in their classroom as part of their curriculum materials, and they just wanted to thank me. And then I was notified that Meg had been named the number one book for reluctant readers by the Young Adult Library Services Association. Now, I never wrote Meg for teenagers. I wrote it for myself and for adults, and but I could see how teens would like it, because when I was a teen, I was reading Jaws, and that spurred me on to read books about great white sharks, and if Meg had been out, I would have definitely read it. And so I realized something important was happening, and my background's in education. I actually have a bachelor's, master's, and doctorate degree in education.
Oh.
I'm certified to teach and coach in secondary school. And I realized something important was happening that needed my help, so I created the nonprofit 501c corporation, Adopt an Author. And basically what Adopt an Author does is it provides free curriculum materials to teachers who register for our program. We provide tests, quizzes, projects, state exam preps, everything they could possibly use. We send them free posters. And the other thing we do is we hook the authors up, and myself included, to the student. Whether students want to email me, they'll get a reply, and that goes for anybody who emails me. So that's, you know, anyone who's ever emailed me gets a reply back personally. But the students have an ability, have the ability to sort of get in touch with the author, and we set up Skype calls now into the classroom for Q&As after they finish the unit. I'll visit schools. I'm visiting a school on Wednesday in South Florida. And it's all free. We pay for everything except for the books, which are sold at discounts. And the program started off with about 8 teachers in 1999, and we've registered well over 10,000 registered teachers into the program since then. And if there's any
wow.
teachers, they can just go to www.adoptanauthor.com and register for the program. It's all free.
Oh, great. Well, I'm going to go ahead and I'll be sure to add that link to the show page description so that when people listen to the show in the archives, I'll have that available too. So, and I'll spread the word about that. I know quite a few people in the, you know, in the education and in school systems that would really, if they don't know about it, that would be a great thing I want to let them know about. So, well, Steve, this has really been a great conversation. I really want to thank you for your time and insight. This is, it's been a lot of fun, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what else comes out from you.
Well, for your listeners, please read Dog Training in the American Male. You're not only supporting myself and my genre as a comedy writer, but also a new publishing house that's available for other authors as well.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I'll be sure to add that to my recommended reading list on my website, so it'll be there too. So, and I'll go ahead and be doing some social media posts on those, so I'll do my part to try and get that out there for you. So thank you again for your time, Steve. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Robert.
Okay, again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Steve Alton. We've been talking about his new book, Dog Training the American Male. Again, you can find out more about that book by visiting LANightEntertainment.com. You can find out more about his other books by visiting www.stevealton.com. And then also, again, if you're interested in the Adopt an Author program, visit adoptanauthor.com. So, everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again, thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's biteradio.me. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Bite Radio Me. And our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.